So now I'll tell y'all the truth. Hi, y'all. My name is Christy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Christy.
Hi. I'm a little nervous. My sobriety date is August 14th, 1991. I want to thank the people that asked me to share, Kim and Kristen, the committee that was there that said, why don't we have Christy? That's a funny thing. why y'all would even think that? but I really appreciate it. I have a history with this conference a little bit. We all do. I'm going to cry. I can't look at Bill, so I'm going to stand this way. I'll just look at you because he'll make me cry. There was a I heard a bunch of people talking about Fellowship of the Spirit in Colorado. They had history of going to that one in Colorado. And I heard them talk, and I wanted to be like them. I wanted to do what they did, and I wanted, I kind of felt like I missed out. I missed that secret little Fellowship of the Spirit thing that they were always talking about. So I got to go, let's see. I just had babies. I just started having babies back to back, and I got to go to that that conference, and I was in a place where I could hear. You know how sometimes you can hear and sometimes you're not listening. I was at that conference and I was hearing a whole lot of stuff, and I think what I felt the most was the fellowship. It was a conference that was a prayer in and of itself. It started on the first day and ended on the last day, but that whole thing was a prayer. It was quite an experience for me, and I went a second time. I got to go a second time, and then Bill was instrumental in trying to get this here. He's always wanted this here for us. And it's been here for the past couple of years, and there's been an evolution. And I've watched and been a little bit a part of that. But I'm so glad that we have it here, because we have the opportunity to build that kind of fellowship, that kind of unity that I think the Valley could definitely benefit from. So anyway, I'm really, really honored to be a part of this thing again. So I am an alcoholic with alanonic tendencies, I've heard. I heard this morning when Kevin was talking. my mom hit me and said, maybe. And so I was like, oh man, that's my title. You know, I'm an alcoholic with alanonic tendencies. But I am an alcoholic first. I know that much. I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana, where it's difficult to tell the difference between the drunks and the alcoholics and just the social drinkers. We all do it the same. But the alcoholics usually go to work the next day, where the drunks and the social drinkers feel sick. And they're a little, but we make it to work. But I was born and raised in a family and in a city where alcohol was just a part of us, you know. I mean, like, New York is a character in Sex and the City. Alcohol is a character in New Orleans. You know, it's part of the culture there. You know, it's always around. When I moved to Salt Lake, I thought, you know, God, I don't know if I could have stayed if I could stay sober in New Orleans, because there's alcohol all around. Here, you know, you got to figure out a code and the path to drink. And when I moved here, I found out y'all found out how to do that well. But there, it was always around. So so when it was time for me to drink, I probably took a sip off of people's drinks. I probably didn't. I don't know, you know. I do know the very first significant drunk that I had, and I will tell you about that. Prior to that, I mean, we had always seen people drink, so we just knew that that was the thing that we were supposed to do. What I didn't know was the effect that that alcohol was going to have on me. My friend Linda and I were by herself in her house. I was about 13 years old, and she had a bar. Everybody has a bar in New Orleans, a big bar or a small bar, all depending on the house, but it's a bar nonetheless. Everybody has one. And Linda's dad had a big construction company, so he had a big bar. And so you could tell where people stood on things was how big their bar was. And theirs was big. And they had this big bottle of bourbon like this, you know, on a swivel with a duck's beak on the, yeah? And you pull it down like that, and then you go glug, 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 like that, and then you put it back up, and then you drink it. And that's what we did. We said, let's go get the duck bill. And we filled up a glass full of ice, and we glug, 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 glug. And then we put a little Coca-Cola in there, and we drank it. And we got drunk. We got really, 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 really drunk. And it was, hey, Hans. She's right here. We got really, really drunk. It was the best feeling I had had in 13 years. I mean, in 13 years, that feeling was the best. We called people in our school. I was in eighth grade. We called everybody. I could talk to boys. I could talk to girls. I could talk to teachers. I could talk to anybody. I didn't realize until I had that drink that prior to that, I was always in my head. I wasn't living out here. I was in here. But when I had that drink, man, I could live out there. And I thought it would be a good idea to get naked and jump off the garage into the swimming pool, and I said it, and we did it. I mean, it was amazing, this alcohol thing, you know? And I blacked out the very first time I drank, which I thought was normal. I blacked out the very first time I drank. I came to. I was soaking wet, not from the pool, but I think Linda, my friend, had dunked me into the bathtub a couple of times, because I kind of vaguely remember a bathtub in there. And then I was in the bed, and I came to, and there was a phone on my ear, and it was my mother. That's all I... What are you doing? That's what I came to. I mean, I came to talking to my mother on the phone. And that was my first drunk that I remember. And what I want to tell you is that I didn't know that I was lacking anything before that drink, but I knew that I was severely lacking something after that drink. And I knew that that was the answer. I had never felt that powerful before. I had never felt that capable before. It was just a wonderful elixir. I loved it. And I don't remember the next time I drank, but I know that the next time that alcohol was around and I could drink it, I did, you know, and that's how it proceeded for me. I had asked my mom to help me with this, my telling my story. She talks a lot. Besides, she speaks a lot. She talks a lot, and she speaks a lot. And she said, make sure you have a beginning, middle, and end. And she gave me these things. And I want you to know that there wasn't really anything significant about my drinking, you know, except for I drank a lot. I didn't have a terrible childhood. I had two parents that loved me. That's what I know. I know that from the bottom of my heart. My dad loved me. My mom loved me. My dad had some other things where he needed to leave, and I like to hang my hat on that, you know, that I had an absent father, I was abandoned, you know, I mean, those are significant, it was significant in my life, but what I know was that my parents loved me. That was the childhood that I came from. I came from a loved place. My mom was always around. She was PTA president. It was a little embarrassing sometimes. So it wasn't that I had this skiwampus childhood, you know. The events didn't happen until I got heavy into my drinking, you know. I mean, the problems really didn't start happening until I got heavy into drinking. And I can't tell you that anything significant happened from when I started to drink, from when it started to go wrong. But I had a lot of fun, you know. I had a kick butt time while I was drinking until I didn't. And when it started to go downhill for me was about, I was about 27, 28 years old, with all that drinking under my belt. I was about 27, 28 years old, and I had moved to Alexandria, Louisiana. It was going to be the solution to all those terrible people that were living in New Orleans. All the problems that I had were probably because of those people in New Orleans. I had the opportunity to move to Alexandria, work in a normal job, be around the Bible Belt people. I probably wouldn't want to drink after that. And I think I got drunk the next day. The first day that I moved there, I got seriously intoxicated and found all the people that drank in Alexandria. The only difference between Alexandria and New Orleans is that they put it in Coca-Cola cups with a top and a straw. That's the only difference. New Orleans, you can walk around loud and proud. You put it in a Coca-Cola cup in Alexandria. Around then, I was drinking a lot, but I was going a lot back to New Orleans a lot. I've never lived where I was. You know, where the it was probably, my thinking was that it's always better over there. It's always better over there. It's probably that guy, that job, that city, that it was better somewhere else. And that was always my solution. So that's how I ended up in Alexandria, because the problem, it would be better over there, but I couldn't live there. I couldn't set my roots there. So I kept going back home every weekend. I kept going to New Orleans every weekend, which is about a 3-hour drive. It's an ice chest drive. And that was one of the hardest things when I sobered up, was to like drive for more than 40 minutes without an ice chest. I was like, why would you want to go? What would you do? I don't know how to drive without that. Isn't that true? So I'd go home to New Orleans every weekend. And this one weekend, this is the beginning of the end. This one weekend, I went down to New Orleans. We drank, got drunk like usual, blacked out. I'm driving. Here it is, Jerry. I'm driving in a little Fiero, which was not my car. It was my roommate's car in Alexandria. I'm driving in a little Fiero, you know, those little sports cars that, and I had just dropped off a girl. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I had just dropped somebody off, and I'm trying to get onto the on-ramp. And you know, the faster you go, and with one eye, you can go straight. You know, you if you go fast enough and you do that one eye, you can go straight. And I was just trying to get onto that on-ramp, onto the interstate to get home. And it had been raining. And what I didn't anticipate was a little dip in the road and a little water in the road and the hydroplane and the spin out and the wrap around the telephone pole or the electric pole, which knocked out electricity in a 3-mile radius, including the New Orleans Superdome, because I was on I was on Poydras Street. I was on Poydras Street, and the car wrapped around the electric pole like this, so it was like up against me. This is, thank God I had just dropped off that girl. You know, I had just dropped off somebody. She would have been annihilated. You know, I mean, I was pretty annihilated, but she would have been gone. And there was a gas tank on Fiero's. The gas tank is in the middle of the car. And so it had missed that. I don't know. But the reason why they found me was because I had knocked out electricity. People started getting up for work and couldn't turn on their lights, I guess. Or they couldn't turn on the switch at the New Orleans Superdome. So they had to cut me out of the car, and they sent me to a charity hospital. I was a Jane Doe, you know, until they could figure out who I was and who to contact. And it was a pretty big event, you know. I was in a coma for about 10 days, and these are all things that people have told me, because I was not conscious, obviously. I wasn't conscious when I was driving the car. But my mother's told me that I came to in that coma for a minute, within the 10-day coma. I came to, and I looked at her, and I said to her, I think I have a problem with drinking. And then I went back into the coma, because that's a little too much honesty, you know what I mean? I'm not an honest chick, you know, especially with myself. I really related to that. I have a problem being honest with myself. I can tell you I'm a slug, but that's not what I'm telling myself. Anyway, so I had this moment of clarity in a coma that I had maybe a little problem with drinking. That the rehab from that, I broke a lot, I tore a lot. I had a long recovery period. I broke my jaw. You know, I had this jaw wired for 3 months. I had to stick French fries through the missing teeth. And, you know, you suck the salt off them. There's sometimes way too much information, and I don't know the line sometimes. Anyway... I'm supposed to sober up in the next 2 minutes. So I had a long recovery from this thing. And during that time, you know, they gave you pain pills a lot when you're broken like that. I didn't drink. The thing that was really in my head at that time when I was recovering from that accident was that I could have killed that girl. I could kill people. You know, I couldn't believe that I had gotten away with not hurting somebody. And that really made it, I was scared from that point on to drink the way that I was drinking. So I'm thinking I'm not going to drink again. But I had these pain pills for a long time to get me through that. So I didn't necessarily need alcohol. I once again lied to myself that... I wasn't drinking anymore, but I was still adjusting the way that I felt. I was about, I don't know, 6 months into this thing, and a friend of mine came over, and he said, you need to get out. He goes, why don't I take you to dinner? And I said, yes, that would be great, and I could have a glass of wine because you'll be driving. That made perfect sense to me. I don't, you know, if you drive, I can drink. And the public is safe. General GQ Public is safe for me. And so we went to dinner, and I had a glass of wine, and it went fine, you know. And then the next day I had a couple glasses of wine, maybe a drink. Next couple of days I had another couple. I was getting drunk really fast, you know, because I had lost a lot of weight in this wreck. You know, I got down to nothing, because that's what happens when you're in a coma and your jaw's wired. I remember thinking that I was getting drunk really fast, where before, you know, I had this high tolerance for alcohol that I could drink a lot. But I was getting drunk really fast. And I remember the thought, you know, I have to get back up to drinking weight. You know, I mean, I really got to get back up to drinking weight. I want you to understand how my mind works. I mean, that's not a rational thought, to get up to drinking weight. You know, it was like that movie Barfly, that I don't know if anybody saw that. Mickey Rourke was talking about food. You know, that's the way I'm going to be able to beat this guy up, or that's the way I'm going to, that's the thought that came to me. If I work out enough, if I gain enough weight, I'll be able to drink again, like I had been drinking. And that was my goal. And a year, maybe a year passed, and I was upside down on in a car. I had gone back to New Orleans, back up to drinking weight. I had passed out. I'm driving a car, and this time I still had the girlfriend in the car. And I passed out while I was driving. I drove up an oak tree on St. Charles Avenue, in New Orleans, and these are, I think they're historical monuments or something. They're in the historical registry. They're so big and old. But I drove it up there, and I flipped it, and my Suzuki was, Sidekick, was on its roof, and we were upside down, and I had gotten thrown out of the car, and I looked, and I saw my girlfriend that I had known since first grade. We were in first grade class. I still have that class picture hanging up on our wall. Susan is sitting there, and she's upside down, and she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her. I'm on the road, and I thought, this can't continue. That I can't continue to live like this. You know, I'm gonna hurt somebody. You know, she's upside down. And the only thing that had happened after flipping that car was that I broke my pinky finger. It's a little crooked. I broke my pinky finger. She had, you know, this bruised sternum, but that was August 12th of 1991. Prior to that, I thought my problem was, you know, my absentee father, my drunk mother, my, you know, all these things that had, I was Italian, I was born in New York, I mean, in New Orleans, I was, you know, they had to be all these terrible things, so I went to a shrink to help me settle this stuff. I was seeing the shrink in between the wrecks, and after the last wreck, you know, I came back to Alexandria and I sat in her office. I went straight to her office and she said, you do not have a problem with drinking. What you have is a problem with alcohol. We have talked about your issues. You have no issues. You know, you have a loving mother. You have a loving father. Your mother's sober now. Your dad's gone. That's not a problem. I mean, what you have is a problem with drinking. When I got back from New Orleans after this wreck, and I remember thinking that something had to change. It wasn't that I had to quit drinking. It was that I needed to fix things so I could do life, that I was somehow abnormal or wrong inside. There was something, it talks about that in the big book, that, you know, there was something wrong with me inside. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't this alcohol thing. She suggested that I go to treatment, as a matter of fact. Her and my best friend, who I also had worked with, had made arrangements for me to go into this treatment center. And on the outside, what I said to her was, you're crazy. I can't believe it. I hope you're going to support me for the rest of my life when I lose my job. And I was yelling and screaming and giving her the what for. And she took it. But on the inside, I know what I felt was, oh, thank God, somebody is taking control of this train wreck. I know that I remember feeling that. Thank God there's somebody that's going to take this thing, take my problems, and take care of them. And so as I was yelling and screaming, going, I'm not going, as I was going because I wanted to, I went into treatment. You know, it was a locked ward, and we had to be in there. They tried to give me pills. And I remember thinking that if this is about alcohol, if this is, you know, if my problem is really alcohol, I don't want to have anything else. I really want to get to the bottom of this. I really wanted a solution to this problem other than not drinking. And I went into that treatment center thinking that maybe there was a solution, because what I forgot to tell you is that my mother had sobered up 8 years prior to this incident, and I had watched her be I watched her be a drunk, and I watched her sober up. You know, I watched, I listened to the things that she said. I'd go and visit, and I'd go to those AA meetings that they had. And what I heard in those AA meetings that they had was the truth in my heart. Somebody, Dave and I were talking about that, or somebody, we were talking about that, you know, when you can hear the truth in your heart. I heard that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt really comfortable in that. Even when I was drinking and I'd go visit my sober mother, I'd hear those things in there, but I'd think that that wasn't for me. That's not going to be my deal. That's her deal, and it's not going to be mine. And I'm glad that they've all found something that makes them feel better, you know. But I didn't think that, I didn't want to be like my mom. But I had, and I think all women have that. I've sponsored a lot of women. We talked about that. You know, there's that period of time that you go through, like 13, my daughter's age. They don't want to be like you. You know, I didn't want her solution to be my solution. But I had seen how Alcoholics Anonymous had worked in her life and in my stepfather's life. And when I went into treatment, all of those experiences came back to me. You know, those going to those meetings, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, well, maybe. I was hoping that it wasn't giving up alcohol, because I really had a good friendship with that stuff. The treatment center was crazy. You know, they had. All kinds of crazy stuff. This was in the early 90s, so they had this program called Say Yes to Life, and there was this guy, it was based off this guy, and you'd have to say yes to life, and they'd have these group therapy sessions, and we'd all go in there, and they'd form a circle, and you'd have to stand in the middle of it and say, yes. Yes. I say yes to life. And there was a lot of us in there didn't know what in the hell was going on. We all sat in a circle, I have to tell you. We all sat in a circle and we all went around and introduced ourselves. My name's Christy, I'm an alcoholic. My name's so-and-so, I'm a, you know, I like red brick. I don't know. You went around the room, and most of the people in there were alcoholics, and there was this guy sitting in there, and he was just looking at everybody. He's all confused, and when it got to him, and he said, "My name's Joe, and I'm a farmer." You know, he had no idea, none. You know, they just had these old country boys in there, and they were just like, I drank beer. I mean, I don't know why I'm here. And, yes. Yes. Nobody knew why they were there. We were hitting pillows. I mean, it was crazy. Hitting pillows. And but the thing that they did do was they sent us to an AA meeting every night. You know, there was a boss that went to an AA meeting, to an AA clubhouse every night. And we went to this AA club. I went because I could get caffeinated coffee and I could smoke cigarettes. Because in the treatment center, they said that caffeine and nicotine were gateway drugs. And I was really into my caffeine and nicotine, you know. I didn't want the drugs they were offering. I wanted caffeine and nicotine. And I didn't care what kind of gateway that was, but I wanted those things. And I couldn't have it during the day, so I went to those meetings. Because I could have real coffee and real cigarettes. And sitting in those meetings, so I heard a solution. You know, I heard these people talking about I was a hopeless drunk. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did these things. I got a sponsor. I did these steps. And, you know, now I'm showing up for what I need to show up for. And I remember thinking, isn't that beautiful? That's a beautiful thing. Those people found a solution, you know? And what I thought was, it was a beautiful solution, but it wasn't going to work for me, you know? That's really nice for them. I mean, I was convinced that I was an alcoholic by this time, that once I put alcohol in my system, I wanted more. I knew that. I wanted another one. And then after that one, I wanted another one. And I didn't care. I just wanted more. So I knew that to be true. And I knew that I couldn't have another drink. But I didn't know if AA was going to work for me. You know, I definitely didn't believe that it would work for me. But I would go because I had nowhere else to go, you know. Anyway, I ended up graduating from that program early because I was an accelerated learner. And my insurance ran out. And But they told me it was because I was accelerated. And I always knew that about myself. I was accelerated. And they, you know, confirmed that. So I got out, and I got out of treatment, and I went to an AA meeting right after that. I still had my job. I had a wonderful employer at the time. They just didn't know what to do with me. I had worked for them for so long, they didn't know. They couldn't kick me out. Plus, I could have been a nun. I worked for a Catholic hospital, and I was still single. You know, raise the roof. We might have one here. So they enabled me to be able to go to treatment. I've got to tell you that these people were very, very supportive. My boss came to. They had a family week. Oh, that part. They had a family week when I was in treatment, when I really admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic as a result of my mother's. My mother came in for the family week. I forgot to tell you all this part. It's really significant that she came in, and she had 8 years of big book sobriety under her belt, and she came to that family week, and it was not like any other treatment experience that I've heard of, but the director sat there, I sat there, the director of the treatment center sat there, I sat there, my mom sat there, and the director said, "Christy, do you want to tell your mother why you drink?" And I said, "Yes, I do. First of all, you know," and it was all her fault. And it was all my father's fault. And the director's sitting there letting me go on like that. And my mom, I watched my mom's face, you know, her eyebrows going up a little bit more and a little bit more. She's like, and there's about, I don't know, it was a long time. She can tell you how long it was, but it was a long time of me, like, since I was three, all the wrongs that had been done to me, why I had drank. She said, "Are you finished? Are you finished with all this?" And so I said, "Yes, but I reserve the right, if I remember anything else, that I can bring it up later," because you hate to give up that kind of stage. And she said, "Because if you're finished, this is what I have to tell you. You know, if those are the best reasons why you have that you drink, then I'm really scared for you, because you're going to die." I said, "What?" She said, "I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years. And what I can tell you is, this ain't it. This ain't it. This is not your solution. If that's the best reasons why you drink, you're going to die." There was something that happened when she told me that truth and all the other events that led up to me sitting in that room, where I realized at that moment, I had that moment of clarity that I didn't drink because of my circumstances. I didn't drink because of my family. I didn't drink because of New Orleans. I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I wanted another one and another one and another one, and I knew that. And when she said that, that triggered that. So when I started going to those meetings, those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I heard their solution, I thought, I'm going to stay here. It might not work for me. I don't know that this program is going to work for me, but I'm going to stay here because I really have nowhere else to go, you know? And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I listened to every single thing y'all said. I went to 2 and 3 meetings a day for the first couple of years of my sobriety. Sick. I just couldn't get enough of it, you know? I remember I was about 90 days sober, and I'm sitting in there thinking, listening to people share about being a mom and being a friend and being in a family, an employee. They were active people in their lives, and I was listening to them, and what I realized is that the alcohol is gone in my life, and I'm a terrible one of every single one of those roles. All I think about is me. I mean, I had this thing in this meeting that came over me, and I said, if there's anything out here, maybe these 12 steps will work for me, you know, so that I can try and live this life that I see other people living. And I don't know what time we started. Okay, thanks. So when I had that realization that all I ever thought about was myself and the way that I felt and how to get what I wanted, and that it wasn't alcohol anymore that was my problem. Alcohol was the solution to the way that I thought. You know, the very first time I drank, that I got drunk, that feeling that I got was that right here, right now feeling. You know, I was right here, right now. I didn't have any worries about yesterday. I didn't have any fear about the future. I was right here, right now. Alcohol gave that to me for a long period of time. You take alcohol out of that, and I'm just back to that crazed person, fearful and worried and... am I doing it right? Am I not doing it right? Did I make the right decision? Did I not make the right decision? me. Jesus. I mean, I was so tired of thinking of me. And that meeting jolted me out of that. I said, maybe it's possible for me to think outside of myself, to be outside of myself. So there's a checklist that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, you go to meetings, get a sponsor. Work the 12 steps, and if check, you know, I wanted to get that stuff done, and I had seen this lady in the meetings, and they said get a sponsor that you want what they have, and she had a really big diamond on her finger, and she had a house in the country, and she had a house in the city. And she had, and Alexandria is like this big, so the house is, one house is here, it's like 30 minutes between both houses, but there was one in the country and one in the city. And she was married, and she seemed kind of happy, and so I said, okay, I want what she has. And so I kept putting myself in her path, because I thought that she would see me, and she would say, you look very interesting. I'd like to sponsor you. and I kept doing that. Yeah. And she never did. She never asked me that question. And I kept going to meetings and putting myself in her way. And then I found out she worked out at like 6 o'clock in the morning. She did those steps. Back then, step aerobics were a big deal.
Yeah.
So I'd go at 6 o'clock in the morning to the step aerobics and try and get, you know, because I knew once she saw me, she would say, you, I want a sponsor. And nothing from this lady, nothing. And finally, about 3 months, 4 months into the gig, I'm falling off the step because, you know, I still had this equilibrium problem, and I'm kind of weebles wobble but they don't fall down kind of person. And so I was falling off my step. I had been going to all these meetings. I had tried to manage and control every single thing in my life. I was doing the best job I could at work. I was doing all these things just right that I had heard in the meetings. And this one day I tripped off the step one too many times. Nothing was working out. I just said, F it. You know, that effort feeling. And I picked up all my stuff and I walked out, and that lady that I had been stalking, because that's really what that is, and she walked out behind me and she said, how's it going? And I looked at her and I said, great. And then I proceeded to put my key in the car. This is way before the beep beeps. And I'm putting my key in the car and my hands shaking and I'm crying. You know, it's like, why can't you be honest for 1 minute in your life? You're not okay. You're going to drink or you're going to die or you just got nothing left. What do you mean? And so I turned around and I am bawling hysterically. And I go, well, actually, I'm not really okay. And she walks up to me and she's like, what's wrong? And so I said, well, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, oh, do you have a sponsor? And I just kind of looked at her incredulously. Yeah. You. And she was like, I don't know you. And she said, but listen, never mind. She said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go home, you're going to take a shower, you're going to go to work, and you're going to meet me at the clubhouse at noon. And so I said, okay, I can do that, you know, and I did that stuff, and I'll go into the clubhouse. She goes, oh, that's who you are. I guess I looked a little bit different at 6 o'clock in the morning than I did at noon after I had gotten ready for work and things. But she spent the whole afternoon with me, you know, and we talked, and she took me into her, her family, you know, she took me into her life, and she just grabbed hold of me, and I will be forever grateful to that woman, because, you know, that bridge from being all by yourself and into the fellowship, you know, she brought me in there. She said, I was going to meetings, the 2 and 3 meetings that I was going to every day were with these old guys that played dominoes, you know, I thought that they were the safest, and I was afraid to let anybody in Alcoholics get to know me, because I thought that if y'all got to know me, it wasn't because I was scared of you guys. I thought that if you got to know me, you would go, oh, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is open to everybody except you, you know, and you're going to have to go. So I didn't want anybody to get to know me because I didn't want to get kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought that was an option. And this lady was kind enough to, she had me over with her family for dinner. She told me to go to the meetings where the young people were, and she got me involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. She crossed that thing for me. She didn't ever work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She taught me how to, you know, clean my house and make my bed and go to work and be on time, and she brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous, but she couldn't do the work with me because she had never done it. And but that was fine with me because I didn't like being told what to do. So I got to know these other people in the clubhouse, and we would go all around the state, and we would go hear speakers, and we would go to seminars and conferences, and I would read, and listen to tapes. And then I'd go back to her, and I'd go, okay, look, this is how we do step one. And she'd go, oh, okay. You know, she was willing. And I said, okay, we're at step 4 now. And she said, okay, what do I do? And so, well, you come over to my house. And she did. She did. I said, and then I tell you all these horrible things, and then you tell me, you know, it's okay. And then we go to dinner. And she's like, okay, I'm game, you know. This went on for a couple years. And I sponsored people because that's on the checklist, yeah. And I sponsored them the same way I heard from seminars and and what other people, I heard other people say. And it was about, I was about 2 years sober, and this thing happened with, her husband tried to kiss me. Imagine that. And it freaked me out. It freaked me out. So I ran away from that. I never wanted to talk to her again because I didn't want to tell her what he did. It was just very crazy for me. And my mom had some friends in Shreveport, and I knew that there was this lady there that had like 50 bazillion years in sobriety. And I went to go see her in Shreveport, and she was my second sponsor. And she said, oh, that every single thing that I had ever done or had ever experienced out of AA and NAA, she had experienced. And she could talk me through that stuff. She got me to, you know, make it a relationship back with my first sponsor because I loved that woman. I loved her for what she did for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to be brought in like that. She had me work the steps the way she worked them. 37, 33 years prior, and that worked for a while, and then I moved to Salt Lake City, you know, and I had a couple of sponsors. You know, what I did was I resisted doing the work that's in the book. I resisted that because I thought there was an easier, softer way. You know, I like checklists. You know, I like, okay, yeah, I'm powerless. Yeah, I can come to believe. I make a decision. 4 and 5, I can check off. Yeah, I was fearful. I was selfish. I was dishonest. Check, 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 check. God, please remove these things. Mom, I'm sorry. 10, 11, and 12, I'll live off the magic and mystery of God, you know. I got a car. I kept my job, you know. I mean, that was the kind of... I went to a lot of AA meetings. that's the way I had always done it. And then when I had come to Salt Lake, I was about... because I wanted to move on to bigger and better things, because Alexandria was a little small for the amount of sobriety that I had.
Yeah.
I needed to go to a bigger city.
Yes.
And I came to a bigger city, and it took a couple of years to get beat to a pulp. That at about 5 years sober, I remember my fifth birthday. I was standing in front of a room full of people, taking my 5-year chip, saying how wonderful life was, and that I wanted to figure out a way to kill myself painlessly. You know, that's what was going on the inside. What I was telling you was a lie, and what was going on in the inside. What I had done after that was I had been going to a 12-step meeting, where I met Bill, and I started doing the work with a person that had done the work, that had a sponsor, that had a sponsor. I got really grounded in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be forever grateful to that sponsor. It was a man. He was a fourth grade teacher. I understood that. I understood the way he talked to me, like a fourth grader. And I did the fundamental work in Alcoholics Anonymous, that foundation, I think, that Adrian was talking about, I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. After that, I got another sponsor. I'm really big on sponsorship because I want to keep all this stuff in my head. I think that I have a solution. I think I have the power to figure out what's going on with me and how to fix that. But I think that a sponsor and then significant friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous are what pull me out of that. The way it is today is that I have huge challenges in my life, and they're 12 and 13. I am a single mom. I have the glorious opportunity to be able to live with my mother and my children, and we all make that work as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to wrap this up because it's the end. that's why I'm moving so fast. My mother's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bunch of years. And I watch Alcoholics Anonymous work in her life as well on a daily basis. We get to use that in our house. I see her making the changes in her life at 74 in order for us to all get along. And that's an inspiration to me. There was a solution in my life. If I just went the other way, if I just went and hung out with that other group of people, if I moved to a different state, if I got a different job, it would all be better. These people are idiots. I had made a decision at about 8 years sober, 9 years sober, to just stay put. You know, I had this message in my head. it sounded like my voice, but I know it wasn't. And it said, why don't you just stay put? You spent your whole life running. Why don't you just stay put? And because I've just stayed put, and that's sometimes all I do is just stay put, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is deep in my heart. I can have a relationship with my mom. I can have a relationship with my kids. I can know Bill for a bazillion years. I can know Laurie for a bazillion years. I can walk through all these things with people, and they walk through with me, and they've seen me at my worst, and they've seen me at my best, and they still love me at my mediocre, you know, just average. I'm thankful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe that I'd have as rich, deep life that I have today. I really thank y'all for listening to this. I was really nervous, and I really wanted to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I hope that I had that, and that you get that Alcoholics Anonymous, conceptually and spiritually, and the spirit of it is about, I don't know, God knows, you guys know, experience knows, and one day at a time I can live this life, the life that God's given me. Thanks.